Welcome back to this deep dive with Thomas Worthland McConkie, mindfulness teacher and researcher in the field of adult development. I'm Bill Turnbull from Faith Matters Foundation. In this episode, we explore the developmental stages that can unfold during our adult lives.
The world we will create will be informed by the perspectives we're able to take and the possibilities that come from that. I think it helps us be more creative in a very deep way.
Join us for this second episode in our deep dive with Thomas McConkie. So, Thomas, you wrote a wonderful book called Navigating Mormon Faith Crisis, A Simple Developmental Map, which was kind of my first exposure to this particular adult development framework, these stages of development that we grow through from adolescence to adulthood. Mm. Is this a relatively new field of study?
First, I'd like to thank you for calling it a wonderful book. It was a labor of love, that one, and it's a topic that I've really been enthralled by for the last almost 15 years now. The field itself is, I would say, newish. It's not surprising to people that children develop. I mean, we all have this intuition that humans do develop, but a rigorized intuition that adults continue to develop throughout their entire lives, or at least have the potential to do so, that wasn't formally undertaken so much until the late 60s, early 70s. So we're looking at about 50 years of data, and the field is changing a lot, and what we know about development is still changing a lot. I think about 50 years.
Yeah, I remember M. Scott Peck, mm-hmm. who wrote The Road Less Traveled, but he also wrote a book called A Different Drum, and he kind of laid out a framework for how, and I thought that was so fascinating at the time. I thought, oh, yeah, so we can actually identify stages that we grow through as adults. And it's interesting because his framework maps, interestingly, over the framework that you use.
Yeah. There's Ken Wilber, who's, you know, highly regarded in this area, in his book Integral Psychology, I think he compared over 100 different developmental map systems and integrated them into a kind of, you know, superstructure. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there are a lot of maps, and people have had intuitions about what the territory might look like for a long time. And you know, we've been more formally collecting data on it the last few decades, and we're learning a lot about what the stages are and kind of questioning, how do we move through these stages? Why does one person remain in a stage for so long and another person kind of blazes through it? And is that a good thing? Do we want to move through stages? I mean, lots of questions about it.
Yeah. So let's spend this segment naming those stages that mm-hmm. you've identified and you and your colleagues have identified in your work, and then maybe exploring how they've unfolded in your life a little bit.
Sure.
And then how they might unfold in the life of a more typical Latter-day Saint.
You suggesting I'm an atypical Latter-day Saint? Yeah, no, that sounds fun. I think we should kind of dive into it a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah.
If I reflect on my life, you know, starting with where we started in the first session here, talking about my childhood, I think it's a really classical example of, you know, what we call in developmental parlance, the conformist stage. And at that stage, our life is, it's concrete in the sense of it's just, you know, what's before us is
And this
reality.
Is a stage that typically you go through developmentally at ages what?
I would say anywhere between 8 and 12, 8 and 13. That's where that's going on.
You've learned rules. You've learned what kind of rules, the things that you need to believe or at least say you believe. And actually, yeah,
you believe them.
You believe them.
Yeah, I mean, you absorb your environment when you're a child. We don't have mature reflective capacities until much later. So it's like, you know, you don't choose whether or not to speak English. If your parents are both native English speakers, mm-hmm. you'll speak English.
So tell me what to think. tell me what to think, and tell me what I need to do.
Yeah,
you're always fighting an urge to this independent urge that wants to do what. But if you want to get along in right. in the culture, in the family, then you learn that you need to follow those rules. Yeah. There's something sort of transactional about it, right?
Yeah. No, I think so. For me, I mentioned this earlier that there was a really beautiful holding environment for me in that stage of development for me at that time in life. Mormonism, it didn't get any better than that. Mormonism, it was the kingdom of God on earth. We knew who we were, where we're from, where we're going, all of that. The security, the belongingness, the divine gifts that rained down in our lives, all of that and more.
Yeah.
I was feeling that. It was incredible. And then it wasn't one day. Then it stopped being so incredible. It was about age 13 where all of a sudden it's like I popped out of that world that was so seamless and coherent and beautiful and flawless. And all of a sudden I had a lot of problems with my family system and with the Mormon church. And, you know, at 13 years old, those objections are only so sophisticated. But I was taking a perspective on my family and taking a new perspective on my culture for the first time and starting to, in a very kind of early and nascent way, I was starting to reason through, like, what's wrong with this? Where doesn't it make sense? Life doesn't need to make sense. Belief doesn't need to make sense at the conformist stage. It just is what it is.
Yeah.
This is the life we live. You know, and moving into this next stage at expert, and I think the onset of this stage, at least cognitively.
So what this next stage is often, or is named in developmental psychology, or this branch of developmental psychology, the expert phase. You transition from this conformist stage to what they call the expert stage.
Right.
Right. Okay.
They call it the expert a little bit tongue-in-cheek because sure. The expert, you know, we don't have the capacity to really reason through things in as sophisticated a way as we do later on in development. So as experts, we decide what's true, we align with what we believe is true, and we use all of our kind of proto-rational cognition to defend it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's defend the faith. Like that's really whatever the faith is, whatever we were brought up to believe, it's highly likely that we will bend our minds and our energy on defending whatever world it is that we came from. So it's interesting while we're just beginning to be more rational, skeptical, analytical. For the first time in life, we're also not all that different from the previous stage. Our beliefs on the surface might look very similar.
So we've sort of absorbed them in the previous stage, and now you're like, okay,
How do I actually justify? We don't have to justify anything to anybody at the conformist stage, but we have to start to justify things to ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
At this next stage, and
I remember exactly how this felt. And
right,
this is when I was in my teen years, late teen years, well, yeah, mid teen years, when I finally got when I was kind of in this stage. Mm-hmm. And I remember the kind of things that appealed to me. One was would have been your great uncle's book, Mormon Doctrine, because that book basically told you everything that you needed to think.
Yep.
And it gave you the reasons for doing it so that you could make a case for it. It's like laying out the argument for all of those things that you believe.
And I think there's a lot of expert language and logic in Mormon doctrine as a good case in point. That's an example of, you know, how that consciousness, how that adult mind reasons and looks at reality from that stage. What's interesting, did you have something?
Well, I'm just reminded of how immature it was of me as a parent, a fairly young parent. In fact, I've told you this story maybe. We may cut this.
Yeah, right. We're live, Bill.
When my kids were fairly, my kids were fairly young, and I had my marked up copy of Mormon Doctrine, of course, like most people did. I got that on my mission. It was allowed on our mission, and I studied it assiduously. But it basically took every possible point of doctrine that you could imagine that constituted Mormonism and defined it and said, thus saith Bruce McConkie, this is the doctrine.
Yeah.
It was controversial when it was first published. It was almost, you know, President McKay, we now know the story, was very much against it and the story of how it got published was interesting. But it was just that the fact that a book like that would exist became what stunk to me. That life is more about learning and discovering than it is about just finding out what it is that we believe in defending that to the death. And so I took that book and I tore it up the spine in view of my two oldest children. I said, listen, books like this should not exist. And they were probably just scratching their heads because they were at a stage. They were probably...
That was all for you, Bill. That
yeah,
was all for your
totally
benefit.
Yeah, it was totally for me. And I thought I was sending this message, and I have a couple of little conformists there that are, or experts, you know, developing right. experts that are saying, I don't know, this approach would probably work for me right now.
Well, I think that's a beautiful point to make, that, you know, in spite of... you know, the intentions of President McKay at the time and probably a lot of other high leadership, the book, Mormon Doctrine, became wildly popular. So why is that?
Yeah.
Well, to your point, you know, every stage has its genius. Every stage has its spokesperson. And to the extent that there's any of that latent expert in us that wants to know for sure and wants to pin down Mormon doctrine, you know, to every last detail, we'll find a book like that and say, finally, somebody who understands me.
Yeah, it went way too far, and the church obviously let the book disappear, and so it had a controversial history. But you're right. I mean, there was a market for it. It filled a need, and it was that need of that developmental stage.
Yeah,
and maybe it says something about where we are developmentally as a church that we no longer find a book like that useful.
I think it says a lot about the church. You know, if we're more generous with our treatment of Bruce R. and Mormon doctrine, we might even say that something like that book had to happen in that moment in Mormon history to help us solidify a more basic identity, like this is what we believe. And, you know, once we had that foundation to work from, we could elaborate and we could become more nuanced. But, you know, however we interpret it, it is the case that the book is not as popular as it used to be, and we're on to different kinds of messages, and Dieter F. Uchtdorf sure is popular.
Yeah, yeah.
What are those tracks he's laying down? I want, me some of that. So
yeah, exactly.
It's interesting how different leaders in the church, different voices, rise to ascendancy, and that has a lot. It's a reflection of our values. It's a reflection of how we see the world, and if we feel like it's being reflected in somebody's speech, and it's deeply informed by development.
Mm.
So it's interesting.
We jumped the gun on this a little bit because we're going to talk later on in a subsequent session about how these stages of development can be reflected culturally and, you know, even in an institution, and how the center of gravity can move and should move over time, we hope.
Yeah.
Moves over time.
Well, this will be a good case study to refer to, and there's always more to talk about.
Yes.
I was just going to mention that when I was moving into the very, very earliest of the expert stage in my adolescence, it's interesting, most of my, practically all of my friends that I can think of around me at that time, they were moving it, you know, they were tracking developmentally just like I was, and they were arguing that the church is true. And because of this rebellious streak, because of this falling out with the family, because of this karma and this who knows what in me, I was being an expert. But the only difference was I was saying, no, the church is not true. It can't be true. There are too many problems with it, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, the irony is that, like, whether my friend was saying the church is true or I'm saying it's not, we didn't have the capacity to actually hold the other's point of view. I was never going to consider in a million years when I was 13 that, oh, yeah, the church is true. That didn't even mean anything to me. And I think it was just as meaningless for me to say that to my friend. They were never going to inhabit my perspective. At Expert, we're not great at inhabiting other people's perspectives yet. We decide which perspective is true, and we bend all of our mind and energy on, you know, saying this is why it's true. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you 100 reasons why.
Which sounds like the conversations that go on at most news networks or on most, you know,
absolutely.
Websites, yes,
yeah. There are applications. Absolutely, you look at the function or dysfunction in U.S. Congress, as the case may be, and, you know, you see a lot of the expert consciousness and the patterning and the value system playing out, where it's, I mean, you're the enemy. If you're a Republican courting, you know, Democrats and listening to their points of view, you know, you might lose your seat next election cycle. So we see a lot of that happening right now. That's an interesting
thing. Yeah, and so there are actually systems and structures that reward getting stuck at that stage of development.
Right.
There are whole systems built on that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's just offer another case study here because I think it's interesting and it's rich and it helps people really get a feel for what we mean by development. But we've been talking a little bit historically about the church and how the expert stage of development plays out individually, how it plays out church-wide. It's a much less popular approach now. The Book of Mormon doctrine is less popular. Any message that smacks of that expert phase that says, like, we know and this is how it is and there's no room for interpretation on it, something about us, you know, it just bridles a little bit and says, well, we know that there's always more to the story. And there's a curiosity, I would say, that's opening up in the church and a willingness to, for example, engage our complicated history. Experts don't engage with complicated history. They say the church is true. I mean, for the most part, that's how the mind works at the expert stage. Whereas at the next stage, the achiever stage, this mature third-person perspective, we call it in development. At the achiever stage, we start to get messier with the facts, and we start to listen to people who think very differently from us, and we're willing to grapple with their facts too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we bring our facts to the table, and we decide what's truest. We decide what's the best way to go forward, what's the best religion to believe in and participate in. We're much more open and agile in our ability to entertain different sources of information at this next stage, the achiever stage.
Yeah, we start to develop this intuition that as good as safety is, mm-hmm. The environment of safety does not necessarily promote growth.
Right.
And we know that. We come to learn that in life one way or another, but this manifests in this sort of move, in this next move that you're talking about, right, where safety is not sufficient.
Right.
It's kind of not even what this mortal experience is about. So to the extent that we put safety as a goal, we preclude opportunities to grow. We preclude that tension that moves us on to other stages.
Yeah, I think that's right. For me, you know, so they were expert years in high school, which I think is developmentally quite normal. You'll see some precocious high school students, they'll start to peek into more of the achiever stage in high school, developing really complex, sophisticated debating skills, rational, skeptical, analytical thinking processes.
And, sure.
But that's something really that our university system in the Western world is designed to cultivate. I think when push comes to shove, the whole system of the university, it's designed to bring you into a mature third-person perspective, achiever stage, where you can be a healthy, productive citizen in a constitutional democracy and, you know, choose your leaders based on, you know, what values they represent, that whole mm-hmm. worldview.
Yeah.
And I was coming into that, I think, you know, if anything, I was delayed coming through high school. I wasn't doing myself any favors.
You don't remember much about civics, so high school civics class. Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, when I look back, we left off the last session with, you know, turning 19 and fleeing the state of Utah looking for, you know, religious sanctuary elsewhere in the world. And I think the next several years, I was kind of maturing more into a kind of an achiever mentality, where one of the qualities of this stage is we start to really ask ourselves in an individual kind of way, what do I choose for myself? Forget what I was taught. Forget what my culture says is right. What do I believe? What really feels right for me? Achievers are good at really introspecting for the first time in a really meaningful way that's decoupled from, you know, their culture, at least to some extent. Mm-hmm. And they can start to say, this is what I value. This is what I'm going to do in life, and I'm going to do it. So we call it the achiever stage because achievers achieve. They look at what they want to do. They tend to plot their course, and they tend to work really hard towards actualizing themselves and moving towards the goals that they feel are worthy of their lives.
Yeah, and you finally have a perspective there where you can function in the world and, plot a course for your life and create in some ways a compelling vision for your life, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I'll also mention, this just comes to mind, but, you know, at the achiever stage, I mentioned at expert that we're still so close to the conformist stage that we will try to rationally defend highly irrational cultural practices and say, this is why it's true. And our kind of pseudo logic can be so convoluted, but it doesn't matter because we know it's true. So as long as we get there at the expert stage, we're good. We've got to prove that, you know, our perspective is the right perspective. But at Achiever, it gets more complicated. And back to perspective taking, sometimes we talk about this Achiever stage as a world-centric consciousness. And it's where it's the spirit of democracy. It's the ability to objectively step out of our own perspective and say, it's where the golden rule comes from. Like, what would I want if I were a Syrian refugee right now and I were dying for a piece of bread and a drink of water for me and my wife and my two young children? What kind of world do we need to create so that, you know, those vulnerable Syrian refugees are just as protected as I am in my privileged life here in Salt Lake City, Utah? I mean, that consciousness really comes online in a significant way at the Achiever stage.
Yeah, and that's why typically that's where activism begins for young idealistic college students. And
absolutely.
It's the first time where they begin to consider these, for a broad swath of us, that we begin to consider these other perspectives and say, hey, you know, what can we do about that?
That's right. And of course, it's still a messy affair because, you know, even as we are developing these new capacities to think and feel in different ways and act in the world, we still have our holdovers from the conformist stage and earlier. We have our prejudices. Sure. We have the parts of us that are undeveloped. I mean, the whole human being doesn't just plop into a new stage. We inhabit many stages and express many values from different stages. Sometimes we're really open-minded and we're actively spending time serving the homeless from a world-centric place. And, you know, the same day we could be in a heated argument with someone in our family and, you know, crashing back into a much more primitive development and insisting that we're right.
Sure.
I mean, so it's a very fluid.
We're moving into new territory, but we have tentatively one toe into it at first. And
Exactly. It's a fluid affair.
You grow into it.
It's a fluid affair.
Right. Okay. So how did this manifest in your life?
The Achiever stage?
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. I think meditation has something to do with it, actually. I mean, maybe the first real goal I applied myself to that I remember that felt like something that people didn't, well, tell me to do, I was going to say, it was athletics in high school. But that was still quite conformist. I mean, you know, you wanted to be, you know, a varsity, you know, first team All-State, you know, something, football, basketball, whatever player. That was more, you know, I think an expression of conformist. It was in college, my freshman year of college, that I started meditating. And there was nothing in my environment that I can think of consciously that ever pointed me towards meditation. I just kind of pulled it out of the ether somehow. And I was such a mess, I think, emotionally and psychologically, spiritually, that I had this intuition like, meditation, that sounds peaceful. And I started to ask around about it. Way led to way. I found books. I found amazing teachers. And I knew I was going to get really good at meditation. Like, that was what I was going to achieve.
How did you know that?
It was a goal. I mean, I think it was a function of the early Achiever stage that I'm going to do something that no one told me to do, but I know I value this, and I'm going to find a way to pursue this and, you know, gain competency in it.
And you started sitting and meditating. Well, first of all, you had someone that taught you, a role model that sort of taught you what this was about, right? Somebody you just happened across.
I mean, a handful of role models, but one in particular that I met when I was 18 years old, a freshman in college. And it's interesting. I've been all over the world. I've studied with a lot of teachers. And if anything, my friend David is his name. He's taught me that there are spiritual giants amongst us. This was an ordinary man that I met when I was 18 years old. I still see him.
So there's something probably that you noticed about him that's kind of just the way he sort of moved through life that showed a sort of a spiritual quality or an awareness that you wanted to emulate or that seemed...
You're right. You're absolutely right. I mean, you can read in a book and you can go to a meditation center and they'll tell you to, you know, bring awareness to the breath. And when the mind wanders, bring your awareness back to the breath. And the fundamentals are extremely important. But what's even more important, and I've just seen this confirmed in my life and other students' lives so many times, that when you really have an embodiment, when you have a teacher that is the practice, the inspiration that comes from that, the virtue that you see flowing from these people, you realize that that's just what a mature human being does. That's what we're all becoming. And there's no question that paying attention in a certain way, aka mindfulness practice, that is really key in how we grow.
Mm.
And this is, there's nothing mystical about this. If you, you know, if you watch Jerry Springer 6 hours a day, if you take in violent television and just watch the local news for crying out loud, if you do that instead of, you know, just coming to stillness once a day and thinking about who in your neighborhood could use a call or a visit, and maybe instead of watching like TV that you don't really need to watch, maybe you open an inspiring text, and then maybe you just feel how that inspiring text just splashes through your body, your mind, your heart, your spirit,
mm-hmm.
and you just savor that for 5 minutes, for 5 hours, like you'd savor a delicious meal you'd just eaten. Of course you're going to be a different person after doing that day in, day out for years.
Mm-hmm.
And when I met my first teacher, I could just see a man who'd been meditating for 30 years, and the substance of his being was qualitatively different than other people that I've met.
So you made at some point a commitment. You made a commitment to actually have a daily practice.
You know, for me, this happens differently for different students.
Yeah.
For me, it was day one. The first time I ever sat still and said, I'm going to meditate, I was a daily sitter, and I never missed. And that might have had something to do, the fact that I sat so religiously might have had something to do with the fact that there was this religion-shaped hole in my life.
Yeah.
And there had been for 5 years. I mean, I needed practice.
The discipline. Yeah. There's something about obedience, right? So when
I missed it so much, and it was so good for me to not miss a practice.
That was something at least you could obey, because a lot of the things that you had those things that you were to obey as part of your Mormonism, a lot of that has gone out of your life.
Absolutely, and it brings up an interesting point. You know, I think it's totally appropriate to call my meditation practice, especially early on, an act of obedience. Mm. And then it gets into this intuition we have, like, at what point is obedience not enough? It doesn't mean we stop being obedient, but it means that obedience is no longer the pinnacle of our spiritual life.
Right.
When I was learning meditation, I read the books. I read them twice. I read them three times. I marked up the columns. I met with my teacher. I wasn't saying, like, this is bunk. This guy says I need to sit twice a day. I'm not going to sit twice a day. I'd say, yes, sir. How long do I need to sit twice a day? That was my attitude. It was mm-hmm. obedient. And then, you know, 5 years into the practice, 10 years into the practice, I'd read enough books and talk to enough teachers to realize, like, oh, people are saying different things, and I can see why they say that, but I'm kind of gravitating more towards this teaching. And I brought more of an achiever mentality to meditation as opposed to the conformist mentality of do everything, cross your T's, dot your I's. And, you know, it's an interesting question in Mormonism. I meet a lot of people who feel like, okay, obedience, I get it. What else? And it's important to let our spiritual practices and disciplines grow up.
Yeah.
It's important to express our developmental capacity through our, you know, our spiritual practice, and not just cap it off at the ceiling of do this, obey, and you'll be fine.
Mm-hmm.
There's...
But not to leave it behind. It's like, yeah,
exactly.
I like that you can transcend and include, right? That's kind of the whole thing. As you grow, you transcend what that meant to you, but you also include it in a fundamental way.
Yeah, so obedience is often referred to as the first law of heaven in the church. You hear that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody important said it at some point, can't remember who, but it's now,
canonized.
Canonized.
Someone said it. When I hear obedience is the first law of heaven, the way I hear that personally is that obedience is foundational. Without obedience, the higher laws and the spiritual gifts that are our birthright aren't as forthcoming. We don't have the proper container to hold those and to develop into them. So there's absolutely something primary about obedience. I think a potential danger to that perspective, and any perspective, is that it can be absolutized. We say obedience is the first law of heaven, so we think, well, you know, be obedient and that's it. Stay obedient and keep being obedient and endure to the end. And when obedient becomes
sufficient.
Yeah, it's okay. I'm not particularly opposed to obedience being the first law of heaven. I think the way it gets played out in practice is that it also remains
it's the
primary and it's the last law of heaven and it's every law in between.
Yeah, there's a reason it's the first one.
I think so.
It's not the capstone of the gospel. It didn't seem to be what Jesus emphasized. He was much more interested in compassion and showing up in people's lives. Would you say?
I would agree. That is my understanding and experience of, you know, Jesus, his ministry, his teachings. And, you know, like if we're going to integrate these perspectives, I think it's really fair to say that obedience is a precursor to deeper love. I mean, we need to learn how to follow basic rules and, you know, get in line with our families, with our communities. That you could say it creates conditions for a fuller love.
Yeah. Well, let's connect some dots then. What does obedience mean in each of these, let's say these first adult development stages that we've talked about?
Yeah.
Like how is obedience experienced and lived in the, say, the conformist stage?
Yeah. So I'll talk a little bit about the progression of like what we see in development, what the evidence shows us, and we can stop anywhere and, you know, kind of zoom in if we need to. But at the conformist stage, obedience is the first law of heaven in the sense that like that is what you do, you obey. It's risky, it's dangerous to disobey from a conformist point of view. Mm. When we're at a conformist stage of development, our world is concrete, meaning it's laid out for us. There aren't nuances, there aren't interpretations. It's just, this is what it is. This is the program, get with it.
So when you're a child, you obey just to fit in.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. Yeah. And it's, I mean, we could spend a whole afternoon on how important that is to learn to be obedient as a child. Fold your arms in the chapel. I mean, human cultures do it around the world and always have done. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, we'll make a plug for it there.
Yeah. It's a normal stage.
Yeah, it's a critical capacity we develop.
Then as you move to, say, this next stage, which we would call the expert stage, which is when you become... You start analyzing, you start thinking about
obedience. That's right. The expert starts to ask why we obey, like, why do we do this? Why is this the first law of heaven? And the expert is quite good at, like you said, analyzing, rationalizing, making sense of why we do things the way we do them. It's more challenging for the expert to actually be overturned. In other words, to be proven wrong or to be refuted in any way. The expert often has a particular perspective and this is what's true and I will hammer you into the ground until you acknowledge that it's true.
And so in the Latter-day Saint Church, the typical what you arrive at as expert is this explanation, typically, that we obey to receive certain blessings. There's a reason we obey.
Absolutely.
And it's to get blessings.
Absolutely.
So it's often called the sort of God as a vending machine model. You put in your obedience token here, you get this blessing here, and it's very, if you want to be blessed, financially, you live law of tithing. If you want to be blessed with health, you live the word of wisdom.
Right.
There are blessings connected to certain acts.
Right.
Makes a lot of sense.
Absolutely makes sense, and I'll just throw in that it works to a great extent, you know, to be obedient and to understand why you're obedient, to, like you said, to receive these blessings. You know, I know so many people who live their lives with that understanding of the gospel, and it blesses them to live that understanding of the gospel.
Yeah. So now let's, as you move through the, achiever level of development, how does obedience change? Does it change there?
I think it can. what changes here is a kind of inner authority, I would say, can start to emerge. It doesn't always for complicated reasons, but let's just say in general that achiever is the stage where a person can start to orient in a meaningful way to their own sense of principle, right? So we talk about this with, I think, a lot of precision in the Mormon church. There's wisdom and insight around this. When Joseph Smith says, you know, everybody knows the quote, how do you get all these people to do what they're doing, Joseph? Well, I teach them correct principles and I let them govern themselves. That, to me, that resonates as a very healthy and intuitive expression of the achiever capacity. Like, we know the rules. We've followed the rules our whole lives. And we know the goodness that comes from rule following, that can come from rule following, and what the rules, why they're there. And then at some point, we're less oriented to the rules, although they're still there. And, you know, it's the principle of the matter, which is it's more generalizable. It's more flexible. It serves us in more situations to live by principle. We can't make a rule for every single thing that happens in life. And the achiever starts to see that, and they start to trust something of, you might say, an inner authority. There are different relationships we can come into with, quote, obedience. It can be obey because the bishop said to do that. It can be obey because my conscience tells me so, which is more of the principle-based approach to obedience. It can be obey, it can be aligned with the Spirit, right? Mm-hmm. The Spirit, we've all had experiences, many of us have had experiences where we get a prompting to do something that it doesn't make any sense. We couldn't point to a rule like, oh, the Spirit told me to do that because it coincides with this particular rule. And we couldn't even necessarily point to a principle. It's in the moment. It's intuitive. We're prompted to do something. I would absolutely say that that's a form of obedience that arises in our spiritual lives, to be obedient to the present moment promptings of the Spirit. And yeah, you know, is there anything more joyful?
Before we leave this topic of obedience, I think we need to point out that at some point, the idea of it can become, obedience can become a negatively charged word.
For sure.
It can, right? How many times have I thought, oh, not another talk on obedience, not another lesson on obedience in church, right? Is there a danger of obedience, the idea of obedience, becoming a measure of our self-worth? And is that... is that a question that answers itself? It sounds like a rhetorical question.
Yeah, it sounds like you've done some meditating on this question, Bill. Well, you used the term, I think you said transactional obedience a moment ago. And I love that you just said that, you know, sometimes a guy who's a, you know, dyed-in-the-wool Mormon, huge supporter of the faith in the church, even you can sit there and say like, oh man, another talk on obedience. To me, I don't look at that impulse and say like, dude, quit complaining. I hear wisdom in that impulse. I hear you and many people, for that matter, saying, I've heard that version of obedience. Is there something else that feels a little bit more like me? Is there something that feels like a more rewarding spiritual practice than just do what people tell you to do? So that, you know, that response of yours, I think, is really telling. And you pointed to
I have to say, I used to have that response more than I do now.
Right,
it softens. I've regained an appreciation for that,
yeah,
for the idea of obedience,
right,
but it's on a different plane, I guess.
Exactly. And imagine had you had a leader, a mentor, somebody in that, you know, environment that could shepherd that a little bit and help you make that transition so that you're not, you know, kind of bunching up and getting tense during a talk. You're recognizing like, oh, they're giving that message and there are people who are hearing that in a different way and it supports them and I can come into a new relationship with it. And I think if we get back to this notion of transactionalism, I do, you know, I put a coin in the vending machine, a candy bar comes out, a blessing comes out. That's how we all learn that way. There was a time every person listening to this program right now, there was a time where that was our entire reality. We had to develop through that. Yeah. So the question becomes, can we continue to hold the wisdom of that particular relationship to obedience and keep growing?
Yeah. The words, the two words that are nails on a chalkboard to me are worthy and righteous, which are very commonly used terms in our culture.
Right.
And they're connected to that idea of obedience. So, And I think, what can you say about that developmentally, about the way we use those words and why they're used in our culture? Prominently.
I would suggest there's an opportunity. I mean, these words, it forms a constellation of a particular worldview. I mean, you almost can't say obedience without thinking about worthiness and righteousness. They're clustered together, and I see a huge opportunity in our culture and our church right now to, quote, grow up these terms, to reimagine them. And it doesn't mean that they'll lose any of their previous functionality. It means we'll leave the limitations of particular usages and connotations of those words behind. And, you know, if we start talking about...
Or at least be aware that when we use them, what message that might be sending internally to each of us.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, righteousness in a particular context, it can shut people out of an experience of growing in the gospel. Righteousness in another context, that righteousness is our fundamental and inseparable connection to the divine. It's who we are moment to moment, and we can choose to connect to that and express it. That's a different way of talking about righteousness. I think it's an appropriate one.
Yeah. If you connect your worth to how you perform according to certain, you know, let's say, commandments, can connect that also to my relationship with my father, for example.
Yeah.
If my relationship with my father was a conditional relationship where I had to do the things that he expected me to do to really gain his approval, that can easily get transferred onto our relationship with God, can't it? It's such a very, very typical human experience, and I wonder if it may have something to do with how we connect worthiness to obedience.
Certainly. Yeah, I mean, we all have earthly parents, and there's a moment, there's a phase in our development as very young children where our parents are God. We don't have a way of comprehending God without seeing it in our parents.
Yeah.
And to this day, I mean, you wonder why you have strange emotional responses around your parents. It's because there's a sedimentary layer in your own psychology that still responds to your parents as God.
Yeah.
So we form these deep imprints, and hopefully we revisit them again and again over life and are able to decouple those two things.
I was shocked not long ago in talking to a very bright, remarkable young lady to hear her admission that she was afraid to meet God in the next. Lisa, very devout,
yeah,
and very bright.
I was right.
Afraid to meet God in the next life because there's some in the back of her mind. There's like this judgment. There's this, I'm not worthy because I've somehow fallen short. And if we model in our families, I guess this is a challenge to parents, right? If we model unconditional love, that your worth and your my affection for you does not depend on how you act according to the, you know, the rules of the family. Though there are rules and we're expected to, abide by them, there's my affection for you is not determined by that conformance at all. I think if we model that better, we'd probably have a little less problem in our theology and how we connect with God.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more.
Let's talk about the mission and development on a mission, because I served a mission. You did not serve a mission. You had a different experience than I did.
Right.
But a lot of people are serving missions. It's interesting to me how how we develop through these stages on a mission. What do you have to say about that?
Well, it's interesting. You and I had kind of mirror opposite experiences in a sense, and we both developed. So it's an interesting conversation to talk about. Well, I've heard a lot about missions growing up around missionaries, and it seems that the mission is set up according to, I would say, primarily conformist expert sensibilities, like the way missionaries are asked to perform. There is a law, there is discipline, it's strict. I don't get the sense that missionaries are invited to reflect upon the structure of a given mission.
And there are very strict rules, of course. So it seems like you're deeply entrenched in that in a conformist kind of mentality, but also an expert mentality, because you are deeply engaged in trying to make that thing you grew up in make sense on a variety of levels. I mean, it's a very intense expert immersion.
Great point. I mean, you were a missionary in Italy, and you, I'm sure, had many experiences of how do I communicate this tradition to people who are in such a different place and context. I've got to make sense of it for them. I have to explain to them at a certain level. Then there's the work the Spirit does, but that's a great point.
No, you spend a lot of time doing that, trying to rationalize and make sense of, but you're also intensely involved in this sort of achiever exercise, because you're learning to, okay, from that perspective, from this gospel perspective and who I am and who I represent, I'm setting goals. You learn discipline. You learn sacrifice.
Yeah.
You learn to exercise your mind, body, in all these in all these really rich ways. So I think a tremendous growth takes place across these three bands that I can see, these these three bands of development.
Right? Yeah. And we can always ask in any given moment, you know, what are the potential limitations of, you know, organizing the mission field according to these particular developmental sensibilities. So that brings up another conversation. Sometimes I've heard some missionaries say they felt like their mission was too focused on baptisms.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that brings up the question about, well, what if we were just with people? And that, I feel a certain kind of, I feel a different stage coming into play when we even ask that question. It's stepping outside of the box of the context and saying, what if we redesigned it? What kind of output would we get then? And it just shows you how fluid everything is. And like the way we do things now, it doesn't mean that it has to be that way forever. We're learning and we're all growing.
You show up as a representative and an agenda for everyone that you meet.
Mm-hmm.
You represent something and you have an agenda for change for that person.
Yeah.
And it's not a situation where you're going to just sit with a person and absorb their perspective necessarily. You try to understand them, but you're not going to really try to adopt their perspective and see what they have to offer you. That doesn't often happen on a mission. It's too bad that it doesn't, because we are in a situation where we're meeting new kinds of people in new kinds of culture. Not that I ever lost my conviction that I had something important to share with people, because I never did lose that, but I also began to see that God is working in lives of people without our help at all.
Yeah.
And that they might actually have perspectives that could teach me.
Yeah.
So there was always this, like, I'm subtly sort of at war with the world, with this instinct that I want to embrace, but still need to hold it, the world, as something that I need to change.
Right.
I don't know what that begins to be uncomfortable. It began to be a little bit uncomfortable for me.
So this is a beautiful case study. If I were to translate this for the listeners right now into a developmental exercise, at the expert stage, which, you know, we see statistically people of mission age being in that stage of development, it's a beautiful place to be. It's a place of incredible learning. It's an appropriate place to be. One of the primary dynamics we see in this particular stage of development is the ability to assert knowledge. This is what I know. Mm-hmm. You know, missionaries spending their time saying, like, this is how I know the Book of Mormon is true.
Right.
And again, part of it, a lot of it's testimony, a lot of it's spirit. But then there's the expert mind that's grappling with reasoning, right? There's asserting knowledge. But then there's this other side, there's this opposite. Remember in Mormonism, we say that, you know, there is an opposition in all things. The other side of the polarity with the expert stage is yielding to knowledge. It's a kind of humility where it's a curiosity, like, well, what do these Italians know that I don't know? I'm just going to be quiet for a moment and let the world influence me. And that comes at the more mature end of the expert stage, where I don't just assert my knowledge all day. I actually yield to other people's knowledge. And I start to recognize that there are different ways of making sense of things. And if that directive were available in a given mission field, imagine the tension you could relieve. Like, rather than feeling tension about, like, oh, this is not how I was trained necessarily, but imagine a mission president who says, like, you are growing, you know, Brother Turnbull, Elder Turnbull, you're growing. Notice for the next 3 months when you're asserting knowledge and when you feel prompted to yield to somebody else expressing what they know, and notice how those play together, and notice the spirit that arises when you're able to be more fluid and flexible. It's very Mormon in a sense that we talk about becoming creators, gods and goddesses, and you know, giving birth to a world. The world, I would suggest this as we wrap up this particular session, the world we will create will be informed by the perspectives we're able to take and the possibilities that come from that. I think it helps us be more creative in a very deep way.